Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, James Garrett, former head of news and current affairs at HTV, Arnus Vale. He's also the treasurer of the National Union of Journalists branch in Bristol, and he talks about investigative journalism. Whatever happened to it? Also, Ian Fraser, Edinburgh-based financial journalist on the new Bank of England governor, Andrew Bailey, straight out of a disastrous career at the Financial Conduct Authority, where the regulator, that was Andrew Bailey, appears to have been captured by the banks. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, the Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen and paper ready at the end of the show.
I'm James Garrett, and for 7 years I was head of programmes at ITV West, previously HTV, ending in 2008. Before that, I was current affairs reporter and producer. My most significant story would have been exposing the Bristol heart surgery scandal, which led to the biggest medical negligence investigation that there's been so far in Britain.
Now, you were making longer films, in-depth about stories. What's the difference between that and sort of day-to-day news reporting?
I think the simplest way to describe it is day-to-day news reporting tells you who, what, when, the nuts and bolts of the story. What day-to-day news reporting is very bad at doing, because it doesn't have the time, is telling you the how and the why, putting stories in context and perhaps giving you the background to the stories, which are important to understand why something just happened, because things obviously never just happen.
Now, I've just scribbled down a list of documentary programmes from the sort of 1980s period, when we only had three, four channels here in Britain. The Cook Report, World in Action, Weekend World, This Week, and First Tuesday, just to name a few. Why do you think it is that we really don't have, programmes like World in Action, which has won so many awards, there really isn't anything like that now on ITV?
There isn't. The pressures are principally financial. These days, ITV isn't the only commercial broadcaster. It's now one of dozens and dozens. And it needs to, or it believes it needs to, put out programmes that will attract the maximum possible audience. Current affairs programming is often a hard watch. It's not fluffy and entertaining, and the sort of programmes that lots of people would want to sit down and watch at the end of a day at work. These days also, broadcasters don't have to put out current affairs programmes. In the glory days of the 1980s that you're referring to, broadcasters were required, or commercial broadcasters like ITV and Channel 4 were required, in return for their licence to broadcast, and basically their licence to attract advertising, were required to put out current affairs programmes. There would be a particular quota, a number of hours per year of current affairs programmes, and then they would also be told that a proportion of those had to go out in peak time, i.e. between 7 and 10pm. And that's when you had World in Action being made by Granada, First Tuesday by Yorkshire TV, and other programmes that we're aware of, Panorama and Dispatches. It's not all bad news, though, because Channel 4 still puts out Dispatches in peak time. The BBC, which sadly bumped Panorama off to a graveyard slot on a Sunday night, has put Panorama back in peak time. So people, you know, there are, and as I say, ITV is bringing back this new program called Exposure, although it won't be, I think they'll want to see how the first series rates before it decides whether to put out another series or not. But there are still programs investigating in depth serious issues that matter to the British people.
A couple of things there. First of all, the Cook Report, when it was cancelled by ITV, was pushing audiences of something like 9.5 million a week.
The Cook Report was a current affairs programme of a sort. I mean, there was a lot of entertainment there too. You know, as much as anything, people used to watch the Cook Report to see the moment when the big man confronted the villain, and, you know, and to see whether or not he was going to get thumped over the head or not.
But one of the things, for example, that Roger Cook found out as part of that, I mean, it might be entertaining as well, was that you could actually go and obtain weapons-grade plutonium on the black market over in the former Soviet Union, which is actually quite an important story, isn't it?
It is. I mean, you know, it's, I suppose, Cook came closest to making current affairs entertaining and, you know, while at the same time, you know, giving you some sort of meaty content. You'll have to ask ITV why they cancelled it.
I think, yeah, I think Roger Cook asked ITV quite a lot of times and didn't really get a satisfactory answer. The other thing, though, is that Panorama's changed quite a lot. We had, just about a year ago in August 2010, a big protest, actually, outside the BBC about factual inaccuracies in a Panorama programme. So do you think there's actually been a change in the way that these... I mean, certainly back in the old days, you wouldn't get a protest from the public outside ITV West about one of your investigative programmes, would you?
I mean, I watched the program about Palestine, and it was, you know, I mean, you know, I can see why people might have grumbled about it. But then look at the Panorama program, which investigated the care home here in Bristol. I mean, did a fantastically good job. I don't think you can, you know, even if there were some inaccuracies in that Panorama about the storming of the Gaza flotilla, I don't think you can draw conclusions about the accuracy of the program strand as a whole from one program.
Now, you've made some investigative programs yourself. If you had a sort of wish list of topics that you'd love to investigate, can you give us a sort of dream documentary you'd love to make?
Well, I would love to have the inside track on the phone hacking scandal. There have been some interesting programs on that. And I guess, you know, it will all come out in the wash and, you know, in court in due course. There are plenty of stories that I would like to get to the bottom of, but I'm not going to tip those people off by telling you.
Okay. Why the phone hacking then? Do you think, because, I mean, quite a lot of people are actually getting bored with this. It seems to be there's a little bit trickles out bit by bit, and, you know, there's nothing to really get your teeth into. Okay, we've had Rupert Murdoch and Rebecca Brooks grilled by the House of Commons, but surely this story's run its course now.
Absolutely not. I think there's still an awful lot to come out, and I guess it will. I mean, thanks to the tenacity of The Guardian and its reporter Nick Davis and its editor Alan Rusbridger, I think they've done the best work on that, helped it's of course by the New York Times and others. I think what the phone hacking scandal lifts a corner, you know, lifts how can I put it, it lifts a veil over, you know, what happens at the heart of power in Britain. And, you know, you look at what we know now, and certainly bear this in mind when we find out in due course, you know, the totality of what happened. It makes you wonder why on earth our politicians were so craven in their sucking up to Rupert Murdoch. Because, you know, they have...
Well, it's simple, isn't it? It's because Rupert Murdoch has quite a good big say through his newspapers as to whether people vote for him or not.
Well, you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, we should never again allow, you know, one part of the media to become so powerful that it can, you know, that politicians feel that they've, you know, regardless of what they think about the man or his tactics, that they have to go along with him. So, you know, it ought to, you know, be a big wake-up call for, you know, for all of us, really.
One of the things that's come out this week is that, what's his name? Andy Coulson was being paid by News International still quite large sums of money whilst working for David Cameron. So who is he actually working for?
Absolutely. I mean, the conflict of interest is clear. Was he working for the Tory party? Was he working for, was he still effectively working for News International? Was he working for both? You know, if so, how can he work for both? Fascinating. I mean, I can't wait. You know, what I would love is to get, you know, I mean, I can't wait for the man to appear in the dock. What I'd love is to stick a microphone under his nose right now and ask him that very question. Who the hell was he working for? I guess you would too.
What about great documentary makers? Is there anybody you particularly admire? Because actually a lot of this material, you can now find it on YouTube, can't you? Any particular documentary makers or documentaries you think that are particularly enlightening that, okay, we won't be seeing them necessarily on our TV screens, but we can watch them on the internet?
Yeah, I mean, like you, I used to be a huge fan of World in Action. Particularly remember back in the early 80s, a couple of films that they made about the Economic League, the Union Blacklisting Company, which tragically still seems to exist in another form. I thought, you know, I was a newspaper reporter at the time, doing my bit as an investigator with incredibly limited resources for an editor who really didn't like my methods because it upset some of his, you know, major advertisers. But I used to watch those programs and think, that's what I'd like to be doing. And, you know, luckily I ended up doing it.
Now, you also made a documentary whilst you were at HTV about the Gloucestershire Freemasons. Can you tell us how you came to make that? Was that your idea, and how you thought it went?
I decided, I was in the fortunate position of being the editor of West Eye View, and the Freemasons was an organisation that I'd been interested in for quite a long time, partly because of their, they did themselves no favours because they were so secretive. And also there were legitimate questions being asked about unhealthy links between policemen and criminals who happened to be members of Freemason lodges. At the same time, the Freemasons themselves were recognising that perhaps it wasn't very clever to be so secretive, and they were interested in some publicity. So our interests coincided more or less, and they allowed us to do some filming with them. In addition to that, I made use of the fact that police forces were going to require all officers who were Freemasons to declare that membership. So we had a bit of a made some interesting revelations about that. I think that probably the standout moment in the film for me, though, was completely unexpected, and it was we found at rather last minute an army officer who had been a Freemason and who was keen to share his experiences of having been a lodge member, and it was quite moving. He had absolutely hated being a Freemason and had felt and couldn't wait to get out. And the Freemasons were very unhappy that sequence appeared in the programme, because it undermined a lot of, I suspect, what they were hoping that the programme would demonstrate. It didn't half make for a sort of gripping programme.
Nick Davis put an article in The Guardian explaining that a Masonic lodge was actually used as a recruiting tool in part of this phone hacking scandal, where tax inspectors, customs officers and policemen were recruited into a Masonic lodge in order to share information and basically be used as a conduit for criminal activity. Now, does that surprise you?
I didn't know that. I suppose one of the things that the phone hacking scandal teaches you there, that it's not to be surprised by anything, really.
We have a situation then where we have hundreds of TV channels now, and yet hardly any of these investigative documentaries are going out. What we're getting kind of slightly superficial coverage just through news reporting. Do you see, other than this programme ITV, do you see any kind of prospects for more incisive investigative journalism in the future?
I see no evidence that Panorama or Dispatches is going away. I hope that exposure will be a success for ITV and that it will come back. And certainly ITV are saying that they're, you know, committed to once again to investigative current affairs programming. you're not going to see that kind of programme on any of the digital channels. Their budgets aren't big enough. And one of the key requirements of successful long-form current affairs programming is a substantial budget. You need the time to investigate subjects, which sometimes won't go anywhere. They'll take you up a dead end, although they looked promising in the first place. Other times, you'll end up with a really good story that, for whatever reason, legal or otherwise, you can't broadcast. And sometimes, because we all have to live within budgets when we're making television programs. You end up making a cheaper, you might call it more superficial program, but in order to make up for the money that was spent investigating these other subjects which didn't get to air. So it's a tough business these days because there are so many channels and because the terrestrial broadcasters, who are the ones that do commission current affairs programming of the sort we're describing, have to live within tighter and tighter budgets. It's tricky. So broadcasters need to be kind of praised for continuing to go along with it, really.
Okay. Is there anything you think is useful about the internet? Because that's changed things a lot. And there are bloggers out there, some of whom sort of class themselves as investigators.
You're absolutely right. One of the problems with the internet is that you don't know where somebody's coming from necessarily. You can have some lunatic with a half-baked idea which looks as plausible as a story that, you know, someone has invested a lot of time and effort into investigating and kind of nailing down absolutely. And, you know, who is the internet user to believe? As I say, you don't always know where the person is coming from.
So if you see a crazy looking story on the internet, is there any sort of checks that you can do to actually see whether this might be a real story or just kind of a fantasy made up?
It's very difficult. I think you have to learn to trust, you have trusted sources and you go back to them, really, I think, time and time again. It's good to be sceptical.
And do you think so? Do you think it's fair to say that if someone has done a report which has got a lot of references, that you can actually find out where the sources are and trace individual accusations back, that actually makes a difference?
Depends what the sources are. If the source is Wikipedia, you can't guarantee that it's true. I mean, I was hauled up recently for quoting a Wikipedia reference and was told it was completely wrong, or it was 20 years out of date. So you need to be sceptical. But I think that's a good mantra to everybody in all circumstances, really, particularly following the phone hacking scandal.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name's Ian Fraser. I'm a financial journalist and I'm the author of Shredded, Inside RBS, the Bank That Broke Britain, which came out in a new edition in May 2019. Which we already called last year. And basically, Andrew Bailey, someone, you know, who's figured quite prominently in my consciousness over the past 3 years, because he took over as chief executive of the Financial Conduct Authority in, I think it was July 2016. And as you know, he's just been announced that he will be succeeding Mark Carney as the governor of the Bank of England.
Could you tell us, how long he's been at the FSA? And maybe we could start by just, you know, what is the FSA? Because it's got a very big responsibility, hasn't it, for making sure that the British financial sector is safe and sound. And we know, don't we, there's a lot of challenges to that, particularly since 2008.
Yeah. Well, it's basically got a, you know, pretty unfortunate history. It was originally called the FSA, or Financial Services Authority, by when it was founded by Gordon Brown in 1997. And then, you know, it was shown to have really failed as an institution in October 2008, when most of the British banks had to be rescued in one way or another.
Yeah, but hang on. What about before that, though, Ian? I mean, surely there was somebody keeping an eye on the banks. Was it Scotland Yard before Gordon Brown brought in the FSA?
No, it was the Bank of England. You know, the Bank of England was the main supervisor for the banking sector until 97. When Gordon Brown removed the supervision of banks away from the Bank of England and set up this new body, which was partly drawn from the Bank of England, because the people who did it at the Bank of England were moved across to the FSA, and it became fully functional in 2001. There were a range of other regulators under, you know, introduced at the time of Big Bang under Thatcher, which looked at various things, various aspects of the financial services sector. So there was, you know, one for insurance, one for fund management, one for banks, which was the Bank of England. And so it was a much more fragmented way of looking at regulation prior to the creation of the FSA.
Well, look, one of the major problems we've seen is auditors. For example, the HBOS, which some say, you know, made a great big contribution to the financial crisis and the bailouts in 2008. Yeah. So what about the auditors? Who looks at them?
Well, nobody really. They're sort of they're self-regulated, because originally it was by the various chartered accountancy institutes like ICAS in Scotland, or like ICAEW in England and Wales. And these were what's called self-regulatory organizations. So it's like profession of, you know, the accountancy profession regulating itself. There was a separate body that came in called the Financial Reporting Council. But this has always been very weak and hasn't actually been particularly, you know, it's been kind of captured, is the jargon, by the accountancy profession. So this body, the FRC, was certainly very ineffective in monitoring audit quality and monitoring potential corruption or mismanagement within the audit sector.
Okay, so what was the thinking behind getting rid of the FSA and bringing in this Financial Conduct Authority that we've got now, that Andrew Bailey's in charge of?
Okay, well, this was a brainwave of George Osborne, and it was the so-called Twin Peaks model of financial regulation. I think Adair Turner, who ran the FSA towards the end of its life, was also part, you know, one of the brains behind this idea. And what you have is you separate out what's called the macroprudential aspect, which is looking at broad issues within financial markets, capital ratios within banks, you know, capital strength of banks, liquidity in the system. So there's a broad, you know, broad brush stuff to do with financial markets and financial strength of financial institutions was to be looked after by a new body to be founded in April 2013, called the Prudential Regulation Authority. And actually, Andrew Bailey was the inaugural chief exec of that body, which sits within the Bank of England. And the separate part, which is the more kind of nitty gritty stuff of, you know, are individual people within the financial world behaving badly? Are they ripping off their customers? Are they, you know, are they nicking money, or whatever you want to call it, which is broadly called conduct? That came within under the aegis of the new body, the Financial Conduct Authority, whose initial head was a guy called Martin Wheatley, who was fired by George Osborne a couple of years later. So you had this split, which was really a Tory idea, of macroprudential into the new Prudential Regulation Authority, or PRA, and you had the microprudential, which is basically conduct and checking people aren't misbehaving, into the new Financial Conduct Authority.
Okay, so in the background to all of this, there was the fallout from 2008, where it was rather a different split was recommended by many people involved, including Andrew Tyrie, saying, actually, what we really need is a split between the what they call casino banking, that is, say, investment banking and the high street banking. Is there any sort of idea still in the regulation at the city that this is a good idea? Because that seemed to me to be the most important message that came out of 2008, if they don't want it to happen again.
Well, that was not so much on the regulation side. That was more on the actual structure of the industry side. And that's what basically happened in the US in 1933 when they passed the Glass-Steagall Act. After all the corruption and scandals that became apparent after the Wall Street crash of 29, and they separated out all the stuff that would be worthy of receipt of a government bailout if it failed, because it involved customers potentially individual consumers potentially losing their deposits. But basically, that was a split which was very effective in the U.S. for 70 odd years. Or more like 50 odd years, actually, which involved splitting the casino banking side, which is investment banks trading on their own account, from the more mundane day-to-day banking of actually servicing customers and small businesses and medium-sized businesses on the high street. The former would not qualify for any government bailouts, therefore the players in that industry would be doing it at their own risk, whereas the players in the utility side, the high street banking, would be protected and would qualify for government bailouts in the event of their institutions failing. So this was a split, which there was an original banking review set up by Cameron's government in 2010. And I think it was something like the Independent Commission on Banking, something like that. And that did recommend something called a ring fence within institutions, so that the one part would qualify for bailouts and could trade at its own risk, and that a more kind of socially valuable side of the business, which is the retail and high street banking, would be separated on the other side of the ring fence and would qualify potentially for bailouts if it failed.
So what do you think, Ian? Was that a fudge? Yeah. Were they fudging there at that point?
Well, I mean, it was called the Vickers Review. It was a guy called Sir John Vickers, who's a professor at Cambridge, I think. And I think what they did come up with was a bit of a fudge, to be honest, because if you know, either you want to split these things or you don't. And just to go for sort of an internal ring fence, which is potentially very porous, isn't necessarily going to resolve any problems long term.
Let's get back to Andrew Bailey and the Financial Conduct Authority. What's his track record been like there? Because he's now the main man. He's now taking over from Mark Carney at the Bank of England.
Yes. Well, I would argue that in his early days, from April 2013 until July 2015, when he was the inaugural chief executive of the Prudential Regulation Authority, or PRA, he did a reasonably good job. You know, that was a new organization, and it was pretty tough. It was hard on banks whose capital ratios were inadequate. And, you know, one might argue that he failed over cooperative bank in that role. But generally, I would argue within the confines of the role that he was given, from 2013 till 2015, so just over 2 years, he did a reasonably good job. Then he became the second head of the FCA, the Financial Conduct Authority. That was after the Chancellor, George Osborne, fired his predecessor for being too tough on the banks in July 2015. And actually, in my view, his track record as CEO of the Financial Conduct Authority has been pretty disastrous. You know, one of the areas that I'm most familiar with is the RBS Global Restructuring Group story. And it seems, you know, that he's basically tried to downplay or minimize the extent of the problem, to misrepresent the findings of an organization called Promontory, which was asked to do an independent report into GRG by the FCA. And there's absolutely no doubt that Bailey misrepresented that the findings.
I mean, for those that aren't familiar with it, Ian, what was GRG up to?
Global Restructuring Group was part of Royal Bank of Scotland, NatWest, and Ulster Bank, which is all one bank under the RBS PLC banner. The main period when GRG was active was 2009 to 2013. And in that period, it essentially massacred up to 16,000 UK businesses, which were mainly within the small and medium-sized enterprise category. A lot of business people who had kind of worked for decades to build up a business suddenly found that the business was destroyed, willfully destroyed by Global Restructuring Group, which was part of RBS Group. There were various ways in which this happened, things like deliberate misvaluation of assets, including properties, removal of facilities, and sudden charging of far higher fees and interest rates than had been agreed to by the customer. There were various methods by which Royal Bank of Scotland and its subsidiary banks, NatWest and Ulster Bank, deliberately set about seizing assets from their own business customers, often through very Machiavellian and underhand means. And Global Restructuring Group was the part of all these banks that did this.
We've come across a story here in Bristol, which sounds very similar, actually, isn't it? But it's attached to Lloyds Bank, something called the Business Support Unit, BSU, based in Castle Park here in Bristol, which yeah. I noticed recently that Noel Edmonds has managed to claim a multi-million pounds, apparently, from an out-of-court settlement. So it does seem as if this maybe wasn't just RBS NatWest, that Lloyds and other banks may have been doing this too.
Certainly, there is evidence to suggest that a number of British banks were doing very similar sorts of things. And Lloyds Banking Group, which obviously includes Bank of Scotland and Halifax, as well as Lloyds Bank, was certainly doing something similar. Clydesdale Bank has been accused of the same sorts of practices. Barclays Bank has to a lesser extent, as has HSBC to a lesser extent. So one might argue that, you know, they were all up to it to one degree or another. There haven't been any criminal cases yet, so you can't say whether or not there's been criminal behavior or not. But certainly there is seriously unethical behavior, and there is how else would you put it? I mean, it basically has destroyed trust in the banking sector. You know, if your bank, which is supposed to be helping you, suddenly becomes a mafiosi type figure out to destroy your company and seize your assets, it does completely undermine confidence in the banking sector.
But surely that's not very good. Surely that's not very good for the bank either. I mean, they want you to be a thriving business, giving a good return on the loans that they've taken out.
Well, you'd have thought so, but for particular reasons to do with Basel capital rules and to do with the plight in which banks found themselves after the crash of 08, and the fact that the bailouts that Gordon Brown orchestrated in October of 08 were inadequate to see the banks through, they all indulged in this sort of behavior. And it, in my view, has been absolutely catastrophic for levels of trust in the banking sector.
So the idea really was to asset strip all businesses that they could in order to back up, you know, to turn everything effectively into a kind of cash reserve at the bank because the banks didn't have enough.
Yeah. Well, in Ireland, I think every single SME customer of Ulster Bank was put into GRG willy-nilly, you know, irrespective of its financial health. So, yeah, it's a short-sighted tactic that the banks, some banks worse than others, seem to have taken in the aftermath of the 08 crisis. You know, in terms of Andrew Bailey's role, I mean, just one example. On 8th of October 2016, he came out with what was called a high-level summary of Promontory's findings. And by the way, Promontory is basically a large consultancy based in the States, which had been asked to investigate this matter by Bailey, or by Bailey's predecessor, sorry, at the FCA. And he said in the summary, the Financial Conduct Authority claimed they'd only found a few isolated examples of poor practice, which is, you know, hugely misleading and doesn't in any way represent what the Promontory report found, that the malpractice and the mistreatment of SMEs was widespread and systematic. It's the inverse of what they actually found. So this is just one example of how Bailey, I think, you know, failed to handle this situation very well. He appears to have deliberately misrepresented what had been found by the organization he had tasked to investigate the matter had found.
It does seem as if there may have been thousands of viable businesses destroyed by this method.
Yeah, well, I think that there is one of the figures that I've seen is 16,000 small and medium-sized enterprises were put into GRG. And of those, I think fewer than 5% emerged alive.
Incredible. What else, other financial scandals has Andrew Bailey been doggedly looking into as part of his role at the FCA?
Well, I mean, the ones that certainly stand out are London and Capital Finance, which involved 11,500 people losing a combined £237 million. Now, the organization was selling things called mini bonds, and I'll call it LCF for short rather than London Capital and Finance. And it was bragging about the fact it was FCA approved, even though what it was doing in terms of selling mini bonds was unregulated activity and therefore not covered by the FCA. And these bonds were promising returns of up to 9%. But basically, it seems to be a very questionable outfit, seems to have basically been a Ponzi scheme, and the four main executives within it seem to have basically funneled out the cash from LCF, which was being put in by investors, to fund their own lifestyle projects. One of Bailey's problems is that regulation is so sort of disjointed in the UK. You can have an entity like the entity London Capital and Finance, which is regulated by the FCA, but what it actually does, which is sell mini bonds, is not regulated by the FCA. It's very misleading for savers or consumers because they see the fact that the entity is regulated by the FCA and they think that provides some sort of reassurance. But in reality, they're given very little reassurance at all when the thing goes tits up.
Well, no, that's £237 million down the drain, although, of course, that money has gone somewhere. But the main point surely there is it's not the FCA's fault if somebody like the LCF is using their name when they shouldn't be.
No, it's not. So, you know, in the case of London Capital and Finance, or LCF, you know, it's difficult to know at this stage how much one can blame Bailey or the FCA as an organization, or whether you can actually blame the structure of regulation and the fact that, you know, it's so disjointed. But certainly someone has ended up with roughly £237 million of investors' cash, and a lot of it does seem to have ended up in projects run by the founders, who I won't name. I can give you the names if you want.
But, please do. Yeah, and that's no problem with okay. that.
Yeah, well, it's Rupert Hume Kendall and Andy Thompson, who were two of the top guys, and then Elton Barker and Spencer Golding, who between them trousered nearly $12 million in the run-up to the collapse of the company, and used LCF funds to bankroll their own ventures. As I said, it was effectively a Ponzi scheme.
Does that mean that their own ventures are still going? Because one would have thought that in a case like that, that those ventures would have been closed down and all of the remaining resources would have been given back to the original investors.
In this instance, it does seem as if Smith and Williamson, who are the administrators of LCF, are doing a pretty comprehensive job. And they are, you know, they are putting some of the ventures into administration and seizing whatever they can back, in order to ensure that the LCF investors aren't left completely penniless.
What about one of our local funds here, which is managed through Hargreaves Lansdowne? That is the Neil Woodford Fund. Now, some estimate as much as £1 billion has been lost from investors there. And in fact, in The Guardian back in November 2019, we heard that there could be another £1 billion could be lost.
Yeah, well, the Woodford Equity Income Fund was managed by a guy called Neil Woodford, who came out of Invesco Perpetual, which was a Henley-based fund manager. I mean, again, you know, I don't necessarily think there's been any deliberate criminal behaviour on the part of Neil Woodford, but it's basically one of these stories where someone emerges as a so-called star manager. And someone like Hargreaves Lansdowne, which is, I think, the UK's largest IFA now, basically decides that he is a star, but doesn't bother to properly monitor what he's up to. And so they channel as much as they can of their own customers' funds into his funds, and don't look under the hood as to what he's actually doing with the money. And in this instance, you know, he made some incredibly poor investment decisions, and he also invested quite heavily in so-called illiquid stocks, which are ones that you can't buy, or shares that you cannot buy or sell easily because they're unquoted. And I think those figures that you mentioned could well be accurate. The investors in this particular fund, the Woodford Equity Income Fund, could lose, I think, around about one third of what they put in. It is currently closed. It was closed in June, or suspended, so no one was able to get any money out from 6th of June, I think it was, 2019. And it's currently being liquidated. So all the holdings are being sold in one way or another, in the hope that investors can get as much as they can back. But I mean, I think in this instance, it does look like Bailey was asleep at the wheel. You know, he should have been doing more. This was one of the most prominent mutual funds in the UK. And, you know, it doesn't look like he or the FCA was doing nearly enough to monitor where Neil Woodford was investing the money. And, you know, there were various red flags that they should have been aware of. For example, Woodford set up his business in 2015, and within 2 months, he'd fired his compliance director. Things like that, you know, should have been noticed, I think, by the FCA, and they should have been investigating it.
So what sort of governor do you think Bailey will make? What will characterise this role? Because it's actually a very, very important role at the Bank of England, isn't it, Ian? It could really make an enormous amount of difference as to whereabouts the investment goes, because we've seen, for example, with people like Richard Murphy and his idea, which is people's QE, that the bank, obviously, it would have to be guided by Sajid Javid in the Treasury, but it could be investing in all sorts of things like public housing. It could be investing in, for example, it could be giving more money to the government so that they could do something like make much more money available for public sector investment of the government. They could even come up with a citizen's income. If the bank was with the right kind of person at the helm, lots and lots of things could change. And I wonder what kind of governor do you think he's going to be compared to Carney or compared to Mervyn King before Carney?
Okay. Well, I think those are all very interesting ideas, the ones that you've just mentioned. But personally, I don't think they're going to be on Andrew Bailey's agenda as the governor of the Bank of England. I think basically, you know, Johnson's government made this appointment. When was it actually announced? It was announced after the 12th of December, wasn't it?
Just after the general election.
Yeah. So, you know, Johnson's government is not going to be particularly adventurous where the financial sector is concerned. Bailey is very much a creature of the existing establishment within finance and within the Bank of England, where he spent most of his career, because he was in the Bank of England before. I mean, I didn't mention it at the beginning, but you know, he was in 95, he was the private secretary of the Bank of England Governor Eddie George during the Barings crisis, for example. So he's essentially a Bank of England lifer, and he's not a particularly creative thinker, in my view. You know, he's seen as what's called a safe pair of hands, i.e. don't rock the boat. And so the idea that he will actually, you know, embark on any radical transformation of the Bank of England, I think, is extremely unlikely. I think he's probably very close to the banks, and his time at the FCA, where he has been chief exec for 3 years, suggests that, you know, his priority is not necessarily the interests of consumers or the interests of small businesses, but it's the interests of protecting the banking sector. Arguably that's what he's been doing with GRG. That's what he's been doing with various other situations in relation to banks. So, you know, sadly, I don't think he's going to be a reforming governor.
Most of the press, the financial journalists, seem to almost as one have said, oh, well, this guy's going to be a safe pair of hands, the right person for the job. And generally speaking, he's got a lot of pats on the back. Why do you think that might be?
There have been some articles which have questioned his suitability because of things like we've just mentioned, you know, GRG, LCF, Woodford, etc. You know, there have been one or two articles which have, you know, said, you know, this is not the right guy for the job. You know, this is a guy who's clearly either incompetent or too close to the banks. But you're right, yeah, there's been a lot of coverage saying, you know, well, hey, what a great appointment. And I, to be honest with you, I don't really fully understand why that has been. It seems like a lot of the financial journalists in the UK, particularly on titles such as the Daily Telegraph and possibly on the FT, they turn a blind eye to a lot of the problems that exist within the financial sector and a lot of the misdemeanors and crimes that happen in the financial sector. And it may be to do with, you know, what I've called access journalism, i.e. they want access to the chief execs of those banks or the boards of those banks. And they don't want to sort of, again, perhaps a bit like Bailey, they don't want to like rock the boat too much. So maybe they just think, you know, Bailey's going to be great and, you know, he'll be a fantastic governor of the Bank of England. I certainly don't share that view.
Also, we're saying goodbye to Mark Carney. How well do you think he's done?
He does seem to have a lot of critics who think, you know, he's not been a very good Bank of England governor. And I suppose, you know, certainly on the Brexit thing, you know, he's alienated a lot of people who are pro-Brexit. You know, some of the more kind of Eurosceptic or Europhobic MPs absolutely loathe Mark Carney because he's seen as basically, you know, he's been seen as someone who's almost tried to ensure Brexit doesn't happen. Personally, I think he's been all right. I mean, you know, there's various blots in his copybook, like, you know, the what was it, something guidance? I can't actually remember the term, but there's something guidance he introduced early on, which was meant to be, you know, he was going to basically give a foretaste of where interest rates were going to go. That failed, obviously. Yeah, but I mean, things like, for example, that he has been campaigning on climate change and wanting climate change to be much more widely considered, and impact of investments on the environment, on the climate, to be much more widely considered within the financial sector, are good initiatives as far as I'm concerned. So overall, I'd say, you know, I'd probably give him about six or seven out of 10.
Okay. Now, we could go back even further to Mervyn King. He said recently on the Daily Mail's website, This Is Money, which is a sort of subsection of the Mail, that there is £166 trillion debt overhang. Now, that he's including things like derivatives in there, and he's saying basically the whole situation that led to the 2008 crash, Mervyn King is saying, well, it could all happen again. In fact, next time it could be far worse.
Yeah, I recently did a bigger piece on all that, and there is, you know, there are real worries. So, you know, if this is the case, then Carney's record isn't as good as one might wish it to be. You know, there are signs that the amount of debt in the system is actually now far greater than it was even in 07, 08, which was when we had a debt-fueled crisis, global financial crisis. So, yeah, you know, there are some real fears that not enough has been done to rein in borrowing or to rein in credit issuance or to rein in complex financial instruments in over the past 11 years. And, you know, in that, if that is the case, which quite probably is, then maybe Carney does deserve more criticism than I gave him.
What about QE? Has QE actually solved any of these problems? Because that's their big solution. In fact, it's the only solution, it seems.
Yeah. Well, yeah, when you've already got interest rates at near zero, you know, you can't cut them any further to stimulate the economy, obviously. So QE was the instrument that was favoured by central banks around the world in the aftermath of the 08 crisis to try and get the economy moving again. And it has worked to varying degrees. But it's also, I can't remember the numbers, but it certainly enabled the top 10% in Britain to become a lot wealthier than they would have done without it, whereas the bottom 80%, 90%, I think, are worse off as a consequence. So, you know, it's meant to stimulate investment, but in some ways it's actually just helped those who have investments. It's helped people who have lots of investments in stocks and shares, or who have lots of investments in other vehicles, to basically get richer, because it's propped up the valuations of the underlying assets.
Yes, it seems to prop up the prices of shares and property, that sort of thing, yeah. Which obviously most ordinary people can't even afford to pay the rent, let alone have some sort of investment in that. But anyway, if you can just round off, Ian, by telling us how we can follow you online and whereabouts we can read some of your newspaper articles.
Okay. Well, you can follow me on Twitter at Ian_Fraser. You can see my website at ianfraser.org, www.ianfraser.org. And, you know, in terms of newspapers, most of the links are on that website, or there's also something called Raconteur, where you can also see a profile page to see some of my most recent articles.
Your book is called Shredded. Most people wouldn't buy a book about a bank because they find it too boring. They probably want to buy a novel or something like that. But what would you say to persuade people that actually it's quite important to understand how these bankers operate?
Well, people have said it reads like a thriller, and I tried to lift the lid on what actually happens inside a bank at a high level. And this was by far the largest bank in the UK, and it was the largest in the world indeed between 07 and 08. Its collapse in October 08 is still affecting us to one degree or another in terms of real wages being below the level they were at the time of its collapse in 2008. Interesting to read because there are some real characters in there, like Fred Goodwin, who was the person who ran it up until he was picked out in October 08. A real prima donna of the banking sector, egotistical and narcissistic. It combines a sort of, you know, story of hubris of someone who thinks he can walk on water, but then, you know, the fallout of that in terms of what the government had to do to try and pick up the pieces, and, you know, the 11-year battle they've had to try to restore the bank to sustainability. I do think it's a very interesting read.
I mean, over in Iran, they execute bankers that break the law. Do you think it would make a difference if they had something similar over in the UK? Because we don't really seem to see bankers going to jail, even.
Well, we don't. And I think this is a key problem. We have these things called deferred prosecution agreements, or DPAs. And basically, that's where the shareholders are stung. You know, they can pay, say, you know, $5 billion was one of the more recent ones that RBS had, to extricate the bank from criminal proceedings in the US. And, you know, that's great for the people who run the bank and the people who were running the individual parts of the bank that committed the alleged crimes. But it's the trouble is it doesn't change behavior. So, you know, my personal view is if there is a serious high-level crime suspected within a bank, then it's up to the prosecutorial agencies, which in this country is the CPS mainly, and the SFO, Serious Fraud Office, to bring those guys to book, or at least try to just not bother and accept a sort of ex gratia payment, which is indirectly channeled from the shareholders, just seems totally wrong, because that's never going to change behavior. As long as these huge fines are just meted out in exchange for criminal prosecutions, you end up with a corrupt system, and you end up with a situation where the bankers basically think they can get away with it.
Okay, Ian Fraser, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Suggest interviewees, subscribe to our email list, and listen the week before broadcast if you like at our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, James Garrett, Ian Fraser, and also studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stoke Croft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk, phone number 0117 909 6897. If you have some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. So thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my 2-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday, midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
Get into the Illuminati, cause we wanna get invited to the coolest parties. By subtly communicating hidden symbology, soon we'll be part of a secret society. Hollywood will open up its doors for us. We'll meet the inner circle of executives. We'll give a guy a wristy and a warm jacuzzi, and the guy will put us in a Disney movie. Then they'll play our music on MTV. We'll be given designer clothes for free, and we can drive everywhere DUI, cause we'll be under the protection of the all-seeing eye. And we'll never have to worry about bills again, cause the Rockefeller family will be our best friends. We'll take finger of fish and triangle, triangle, eye, pyramid.
You can be rich and famous too.
I love the establishment. Yay! We want to get into the Illuminati, and we want to hang out with Jay-Z and Beyonce. We want to sell our souls in a billion records and bow before our reptilian overlords. Then the enlightened few will bring us into the fold, where we'll be told secrets of old, like why the CIA killed JFK and why on Earth the moon landing was fake. Being Illuminati will be so much fun. We'll learn the truth about Area 51. They'll tell us where Flight MH370 is and which politicians like to leave. Get a million followers on Instagram. We'll have the whole wide world in our hearts. The Rothschilds will take us to Bohemian Grove, where it's likely that we'll both be murdered and cloned. Let's manipulate the economy.
War is good for humanity.
We'll be given the keys to unlock the Bible, and we'll become Lucifer's loyal disciples. We'll pray to Baphomet and the princes of hell. We'll bathe in under the blood moon, beneath Saturn's radiant energy, before the Dark Lord Lucifer himself, I invoke the four crowned princes of hell, inviting the forces of darkness to bestow their knowledge and power upon me. I, your faithful servant, promise to hide triangles in things, perform at the Grammys, and tell people the earth is round. From this day forth, I'll do whatever it takes to thwart globalism, multinational corporations, the establishment, and the military-industrial complex. I love fracking. It's the best. Let's go for some pizza.
What flavor?
Kitty flavor. We're gonna get assassinated for making this video.
More like initiated.